dinjiizhuh.com. I'm Christine Genier. Soko seni denet e. Take good care out there.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin.
Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji hina.
Ekose.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
This is Bird Note. These rich, caroled phrases are among the best loved and most widely heard in North America. This superb song belongs to perhaps our most familiar bird, the American robin. As singers go, the robin is exceptional. They're often the first birds to sing in the morning, starting well before dawn, and the last you'll hear in the evening, holding forth into deep twilight. Robins also begin singing earlier in the year than most birds, often in midwinter. And robins can be remarkably long-winded. While their average song strings fewer than a dozen short phrases together and lasts a few seconds, robins sometimes sing for minutes without a pause. But the most extraordinary measure of robin's song is its variety. In each song, a robin sings a varied selection from a repertoire of 10 to 20 different caroling phrases. Then, as evening comes on, the same robin interweaves these phrases with exquisite whisper-like notes from its personal treasury of 75 to 100 different whispered notes. The potential song variety is amazing. The musical results, enchanting. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And Dawalawan, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. The District of Kitimat and the Haisla Council celebrated the signing of a friendship agreement at the celebration at Minyet Bay West Park on June 2nd, marking the culmination of a two-year initiative under the Community Economic Development Initiative Program. This agreement solidifies their commitment to collaborative economic development and cultural initiatives, highlighting a strengthened relationship focused on mutual respect and inclusive community engagement. CFNR spoke with Kitimat Mayor Phil Germuth regarding the friendship agreement.
Phil Germuth, Mayor for the District of Kitimat.
Can you provide an overview of the friendship agreement between the District of Kitimat and the Haisla Nation?
Yeah, sure, Sabrina. You know, I'm going to go back a few years and how this process really got to where we are today. And so how it really started was basically in late 2014, early 2015, the catalyst for this whole friendship agreement where we got today. The catalyst in getting us there was really LNG Canada, and I give them so much credit for being the party that really brought us together, Haisla Nation and District of Kitimat. And what they did back in the day, and they still do today, is when they were giving updates on the project, instead of just having, you know, a meeting with the Haisla Nation Council and then another one with District of Kitimat, they brought us both together. And that really gave us the opportunity as the two councils to get to know the people behind the title. Right? So in a relaxed situation. So we got to actually build friendships with Haisla Nation Council. And we got to know each other, not just on the political basis, but as friendships. And so, you know, we built these friendships and relationships, and things went from there. And so with LNG Canada bringing us together like that, it really put us on the right path. And so from that, well, we'll fast forward then to May 4th of 2018, when we had the Friendship Pole celebration, and that was a friendship pole that was put on Haisla Center, which is right dead center in the community on the Haisla lands. And that was a friendship pole there, and we had a celebration and a feast on that. And that was really great. And that really, it was put there for a reason, right in the center. And so it's a reminder every single day when we drive by there that, you know, to remember that when we're making decisions that we think about the Haisla and have the perspective in there. And so that was a really great day. So then from that May 4th, 2018, we kept on working together, doing what we could. But then things really, really went forward faster when we got part of the SETI process, and that was in March of 2022. And so the SETI program is the Community Economic Development Initiative, and it's a program managed by the Federation of Canadian Municipalities, FCM, and CANDU, which is the Council for Advancement of Native Development Officers. You know, we did the interview process with both us and the Heisel on the phone and why they should take us into this program. And so, yes, we were one of the lucky ones, and that went on for 2 years, and that was really great program. Marissa Lawrence was the facilitator, and she's done these before and really had great ideas of setting the framework for how we work together. And so out of that, we formed a few committees. One of them is a land and marine use planning. There's one for tourism and things like that. And how do we work together on these? So that went on for basically the 2 years. And then that led us to this year of June 2nd, where we did the Minette Bay Park opening, which was on Indigenous Peoples Day. And that was the signing of the friendship agreement and also planting a cedar tree between the two of us. And so, of course, that tree, as that tree grows, we're seeing our relationship grow as that tree goes into the future. So, but the SETI program, yeah, was really an outstanding process of how to work together and us understanding how each councils work and how each administrations work. And so, you know, the hope down the road is that we see in the future that future generations, the communities and the elected officials will be able to look back on the process that we went through and say, hey, you know what? They got it right, and we're reaping the benefits of what they did way back then. So that's what we're hoping that we see out of this in the future.
What does the agreement signify for both communities involved?
So I think that the agreement signifies of how we're going to work together and just how important that is. You know, we're like this year, even on July 1st, you know, July 1st has always been a big event in Kitimat for Canada Day. And this year, it's going to be even cooler because we're having what's a Heisla Cultural Experience Pavilion. And so what we did as the district is we hired a full-time Indigenous Relations Indigenous Relations Manager. And so Deanna, she's doing an amazing job. And she is setting up this whole experience pavilion so the people of Kitimat actually get a chance to experience some of the history and culture of the Heisla on July 1st. So that's one of the things, and that's a full-time position, and it's working out very, very well. And that allows all the decisions that, you know, staff are looking at and stuff to have some Heisla input into them, too. So gives us more of working together and thinking about things, how they might affect the Heisla Nation. So that's working out very, very well. Of course, we built the Heisla Bridge, of course, and on that we incorporated Heisla art onto the new Heisla Bridge, which worked out really well. It looks so cool. It's backlit. So what they did is they took like steel plates and then they had like laser cut them and then they're backlit. And it's the original six clans of the Heisla on there. So as you walk over the bridge at night, you can see these backlit metal cutout, laser cutout things of the original six bands of the Heisla, which is really cool. We're also, work is ongoing on trailhead signage, incorporating the traditional names and information in collaboration with the Heisla. And so there's lots of things going on like that. So it's working out very, very well. We're very proud of the relationship that we're building with the Heisla. Of course, this isn't something where it's ever going to be finished. It's just something you're going to continually go on. And of course, being so close to each other, you know, over these decades, you know, you've seen industry come and go. But the fact is, we're always going to be neighbors. And so it really makes sense for us to work together for the benefit of both our communities.
How will the friendship agreement promote cultural exchange and understanding between the District of Kitimat and the Heisla Nation?
So I guess it promotes that, but what you're seeing on July 1st is the Cultural Experience Pavilion. It's giving the people of Kitimat an opportunity to learn even more about the Heisla Nation, about their culture and their history, and you know, learning about those who were here, you know, millennia before we were. And so it's one of those things of it's going to be continually ongoing, and I think that's how it's going to promote that, to keep going on that and learning. And one thing, we as council, of course, and staff, you know, we're not going to be there forever either in our positions, right? So we're making sure that, you know, we've got something in place to make sure that those that come after us are going to be updated so that they know what's going on, so we can continue this process as we move into the future.
Is there anything else you'd like to share or add at all today?
After that, no, I also want to give another big thank you to LNG Canada, who really started this process, and how much they've done for our communities and our relationship. They really do deserve a lot of credit for that. and how they went about communicating and consulting with both of us. So we would not be anywhere near as far as we are today without them have been the catalyst for that process. So big thank you to them, too. And, of course, the trust that the Haisla Nation, I believe, has in us now, that we are truly committed to wanting to see that relationship work for the both of us. So very, very proud of that and, very privileged to be a part of this whole process, I think.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You could see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
As a part of Capture Festival, the Polygon is excited to announce part one of Danny Gall's epic work, Historical Records. Featuring 246 LPs arranged chronologically from the years 1877 to 1989, the work has been dubbed a history painting and chronicles speeches and interviews of those who were in power, others who objected to this power, of war and peace agreements, human rights struggles, and other radio broadcasts of the events that shaped history. The exhibition includes a listening station with access to Danny Gall's most recent works for radio and the full sonic archive of historical records. Along with that, there's a book available where the artist deep dives into the almost disappeared phenomenon of sound documents. Admission is donation-based, and if you want to learn more, head over to thepolygon.ca/exhibition/Danny Gall Historical Records.
Myself, for the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war.
This is a CH1 News update.
Safety for women, let's unite.
Safety for women, let's unite.
Equality is our right.
Equality is our right.
On the second anniversary of Roe v. Wade being overturned in the United States, almost 100 people gathered outside the Nanaimo Courthouse on Monday, June 24th, to strike for better rights for autonomy over women's bodies and existence. The gathering in Nanaimo was a part of a women's strike happening across Canada and the United States, recognizing the need to continue fighting for reproductive rights. In 2022, Roe v. Wade was overturned, ending the legal case from 1973 that saw the U.S. Supreme Court rule 7-2 that the restriction of abortion services by state regulation was unconstitutional. A Nanaimo strike organizer and clinical counselor Stephanie Peter told a crowd that while the overturn of Roe v. Wade may only affect those in the U.S., it is important to pay attention to what is happening in Canada.
There's still so much further that we need to go in terms of pay equity, in terms of safety, in terms of equality. And to see that it's going in the wrong direction is deeply, deeply worrying and upsetting. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're all here today.
Sarah Cameron, a local health worker and 2S LGBTQIA+ advocate, also spoke at the strike. Cameron, who is a transgender woman, shared what she noticed through her gender transition. She said until her transition, she was only able to experience the perspective of being a woman from the point of view of someone perceived to be a man. She says it wasn't until her transition that she started to notice and understand the inequalities that all women face.
Sometimes now I'm talked over by colleagues a lot more than I used to be. It never used to happen, in fact. My work is sometimes questioned. That never used to happen. This never happened that way before. I have unwanted advances from men sometimes at work or randomly when I'm just minding my own business.
She says in the United States, women, including transgender women, are losing more rights to what they can do with their bodies.
This is a concern for everyone, a sign of things to come for all women. The removal of trans rights has been a testing of our tolerance for the removal of rights. And we saw this in the U.S. with the right to choose now taken away. So could this happen here in Canada? Yes.
Cameron says there has been similar shifts in societal acceptance happening in Canada, and it is time for people to recognize what's happening in the United States could happen in Canada as well. She says it's important to pay attention to local politics and school board trustees and board elections, even if, as she says, it seems obscure or pointless. She points out a former school board trustee in Chilliwack who had strong anti-SOGI, or sexual orientation and gender identities, views on the curriculum that teaches kids about sexual orientation and gender identities.
The good news is that this man is a former school board trustee. He tried to get reelected, but folks organized to make sure that didn't happen. So we can take action and we can make a real difference.
After the speeches, CHY spoke with Stephanie Peter and Patty Dyer about the strike. Peter says she's only recently gotten into the women's movement and the fight for reproductive rights, although she has experienced sexism and misogyny all throughout her life.
Since I was a teenager, I've become aware of misogyny, I've become aware of you know, feeling like a second-class citizen, feeling like there's things I can't do, and butting up against that and finding it really frustrating and irritating because there's no logical reason for it. But I didn't get involved.
She says it wasn't until Roe versus Wade was overturned that she got involved in the movement.
You know, that's been there since 1973. I'm in my 60s now, so my entire reproductive life, I've known that abortion was legal in the States and at least not illegal in Canada.
Dyer also came into the movement later in life.
I mean, I've been led by example, and I've certainly been vocal, but I have not been an activist. I have not been someone who's on the forefront. But I really do feel like times are changing, and I need to become more so that, you know, so this opportunity came at the right time that I think we are at a turning point. And so I think it is really important that we do start to stand up and we do start to speak out more publicly.
Peter says the strike is to raise awareness of the three main topics: bodily autonomy and reproductive rights, stopping gender-based violence, and gender equal rights for women.
You know, there's still only 30% of the people in decision-making positions of power in Canada are women, and 6% women of color. So, you know, those are really disappointing stats. We should be much further ahead than that.
She also points out the gender pay gap across the country that differs in size in each province and territory. According to the BC government, in 2022, women were paid 17% less than men, with an average hourly salary for men being $35.50 per hour compared to $29.53 per hour for women. It also found that Indigenous, racialized, and immigrant women had an even lower average wage. New pay transparency legislation that came into effect on November 1st of last year requires all publicly advertised jobs to include wage or salary ranges. Peter tells CHOY that while there are reproductive rights across the country, the situation is different from province to province.
I'd say we're pretty lucky in BC. For instance, when it comes to abortion, we have access to abortion for the first 25 weeks of pregnancy. In New Brunswick, they have access for the first 13. Most women don't know they're pregnant until they're about 6 weeks pregnant. So that gives you 7 weeks in which to get an appointment and to go through the wait list and to be served. And that's not happening in New Brunswick. So women are leaving the province to have an abortion in New Brunswick.
Currently in BC, abortions are available in the province and are covered for residents under the Medical Service Plan. In February of this year, Action Canada for Sexual Health and Rights made a statement saying the New Brunswick government's lack of funding for surgical abortions outside of a hospital setting is forcing community abortion clinics to close. Currently in New Brunswick, there are only three hospitals that can offer abortion services up to 13 weeks. The closure of community abortion clinics could then lead to longer wait lists to access the services in the province, which would end up being a wait time longer than 13 weeks. Peter, whose daughter was in attendance at the strike, says it's important to protect the current abortion rights so the future generation will still have access to them. She says as the provincial election is coming up this year and the federal election will be happening next year, it's important to pay attention to candidates and what they stand for.
When you add up the number of women, non-binary, and trans Canadians, it's almost 20 million. That's a lot of votes. I think that that if we act in our own best interests and we can communicate and discuss and share information, then that's one big thing that we can do.
Dyer adds that it's important to continue being engaged with the movement and continue having conversations about the current state of reproductive and women's rights across the country and in the United States. For CHOY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
Free abortion on demand.
Free abortion on demand.
From BC to Newfoundland.
From BC to Newfoundland.
When bigots attack, we fight back.
When bigots attack, we fight back.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like...
Attention, women in science, technology, engineering, and math. Whether you're a seasoned professional or just starting on your journey, the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology is here to support you every step of the way. From mentorship programs to networking and skill-building events, we've got the tools and resources you need to succeed and thrive in STEM. Visit SCWIS.ca to learn more. That's SCWIST.ca. We can't wait to connect with you.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Eye on the Valley right here on CIVL 101.7 FM, broadcasting to the Fraser Valley, broadcasting from the University of the Fraser Valley, Abbotsford campus on the traditional and unceded territory of the Stolo people. I have a great episode for you today. A few weeks back, I spoke with Fred Fox, Terry Fox's older brother, on the impact that Terry Fox has on people even today. And with Terry Fox's 43rd death anniversary, today, I would like to rebroadcast that interview for you today. My own challenges in life, I used to be inspired by your brother's story. I was born as your brother had passed away, but so I didn't get to hear his story from his own mouth, but I read about it in books, and I was inspired by his story to the extent that I face my own challenges by looking at him like a role model. How does it make you feel when other individuals that you talk to in schools and stuff come up to you and say how they were inspired by Terry's story to overcome their own challenges?
Yeah, you know, I hear about it all the time. And, you know, when I get a chance to travel across the country and share Terry's story, it's largely about Terry, of course, and growing up with Terry, about Terry's cancer story and running across Canada and feeling that it's so important to raise money for cancer research. But, you know, I'm talking, when I'm at schools especially, I'm talking to, obviously, students that weren't born 44 years ago. And in many cases, well, most cases, their parents weren't born 44 years ago, and some of their teachers weren't. So it's this new generation of students that we're talking to and sharing Terry's story. But I have people coming to me all of the time, different ages, people that were around in 1980 when Terry was running and remember watching Terry. And I often say that, you know, Terry's story is about cancer and cancer research and fundraising for that. But Terry inspires so many people to go above and beyond their own obstacles that they face. And I have people coming up to me all of the time that say, you know, and people who with disabilities that come to me and say that they look to Terry all the time to be able to get beyond, to be able to work harder to do what they do. When Terry was diagnosed with cancer and he lost his leg and he had to go to the rehab center in Vancouver to figure out how to walk with an artificial leg, that was difficult. But Terry had this positive attitude with those at the Vancouver rehab center where he went, Jeff Strong, to work harder. And so people coming to me and saying Terry inspired me, you know, maybe and for different reasons. Some people who were at a low point in their life that maybe were going in the wrong direction and remember seeing Terry run and that changed their lives they changed the direction that they were going in. And then people with disabilities, seeing what Terry did as, when Terry was running across Canada, when he started in Newfoundland, it was -5 degrees. He ran through a couple of snowstorms, but he wore shorts during that time so he could show people that he was an amputee and Terry believed that anything is possible if you try, no matter what your ability or what your disability might be. You know, anything is possible if you put it in. And I think so many people have been inspired by that.
You, being Terry Fox's older brother, would know Terry more than any one of us. How do you think Terry would react right now if he could be told that his story has inspired not only people with cancer, but people facing other challenges in the millions? How do you think that would impact him right now?
Terry would be so proud. I mean, not only knowing that the money that's been raised, that, you know, when he left Newfoundland, he thought he could raise $1 million. That was his goal. And then it changed. His goal changed at one point during the Marathon of Hope to $1 for every Canadian. At the time, there's 24 million people in Canada. You know, to date, there's been over $900 million raised from Terry Fox runs and all of that. But Terry would be so proud of that and how people took on that challenge that Terry gave each and every one of us before he passed away to continue what he started. But Terry would also be equally as proud to know that he's inspired others, you know, with people without a cancer diagnosis, people with whether it's a physical disability or any kind of disability obstacle that they're facing. That would make Terry equally as proud. because that's, as I mentioned earlier, that's why he ran in those early days when the weather was freezing cold with wearing shorts, not sweatpants, because he wanted people to know that Kerry didn't see the fact that he had an artificial leg, that he was running with a prosthetic, that he was disabled. He didn't feel that that was who he was, and he wanted to show people that. So I think that's why he ran without sweatpants. He ran in shorts in those coldest weathers because he wanted to show people that he was an amputee. He wanted to show that anything is possible, that you can get beyond those obstacles, and he would be so proud to know today that he inspires others to with the same kind of obstacles that he faced to get beyond those as well. I think that would probably inspire Terry almost more than anything else.
And what is your final message to our listeners today?
Terry would say often when he was running across Canada that he was just an average, ordinary Canadian kid that. He wasn't the best athlete before his cancer diagnosis. He wasn't the best student in class. He had to work harder than anybody. And Kerry would say that was the same thing after cancer, after his amputation, that he had to work harder. And Kerry truly believed, and Kerry would say this even when he was first. When he was diagnosed a second time in Thunder Bay and had to stop his marathon hope, Terry said in the press conference that they had, Terry said, "I just wish that people would realize that anything is possible if you try, that dreams are made if you try." And I think Terry would hope that anyone with a disability, anyone facing any kind of an obstacle that they face, that if you believe that, a little bit of effort, a little bit of try, your dreams, your hopes will come true. That's how Terry felt. That's what Terry believed. And I think if anybody out there is having a bit of a struggle, just believe that if it's through your effort and your hard work and your positive attitude, as Terry said, dreams are made if you try.
And like I've told you before and multiple times, I was inspired by your brother's story big time. So thank you so much for sharing him with us.
Well, thank you. And thank you for sharing Terry's story and, sharing that for other people who, need that extra inspiration. Again, Terry has done that for so many people. So thank you, Sarjeet, for doing this.
Thank you for listening to Eye on the Valley right here on CIVL 101.7 FM with your host, Sarjeet Awal. Join me again next week as I have another great episode for you. This program was sponsored by the Local Journalism Initiative.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Will Glazik, a fifth-generation farmer in Paxton, Illinois, hopes you'll take a shot at reducing global warming. A shot of whiskey, that is. Glazik and his siblings run Silver Tree Beer and Spirits. They make vodka and whiskey from grain grown on their family farm.
We're literally having our hands in every step.
And they're committed to making it sustainable. They avoid tilling, which churns up the soil and releases carbon to the atmosphere.
We're using livestock manures and cover crops for fertility on our fields. We're not bringing on any synthetic fertilizers, which are very carbon intensive for production and transportation.
To encourage a larger shift in the industry, his company launched the Take a Shot at Climate Change initiative. Participating distilleries agree to buy their grain from farms that store more carbon than they produce. They must be verified by Comet Farm, a tool developed by the USDA and Colorado State University. Just a small fraction of farmland in the U.S. is used to grow grain for spirits.
But it is a significant enough land base that we can, as farmers, start having an impact on our environment.
Glazik says that by role modeling sustainable practices, a few farmers can inspire larger change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Tune in to Intravenous on Wednesdays from 10 to 11 a.m. for music and talk radio about all things, all genders. discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through an intersectional feminist lens, our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony. IntraVenus, every Wednesday morning from 10 to 11, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.